Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy post-Memorial Day weekend week.
Yeah, hope everyone's back in the swing of work. Hope you're no longer hungover. Whatever thing you were doing over the weekend, I hope it was fun. I hope you at least poured one out, if not more, for the fallen troops over the course of America's history. Obviously, that's what Memorial Day is mostly about, besides just the barbecues and the kickoff to summer type stuff that we've kind of turned it into. That said, Dan, how do you want to start us off this week? I feel like there's not a lot of Syracuse things going on. Obviously, there's one topic I know we wanted to hit on, but is there anything else that you need to get off your chest before we jump into to what's become a burgeoning emoji fight?
No, I think that's what the people want to hear. Like, the emoji wars of 2017 are upon us, and battle lines have been drawn.
Fair enough. Yeah, you guys expressed that you wanted a little more hate week type stuff, a little more animosity between fan bases. I know that's kind of gone down a bit as we've joined the ACC, Clemson excluded. But yeah, I think we were able to ignite something with the fan base I didn't realize we had anything against.
Well, the older, yes, I think older Syracuse fans definitely harbor some resentment. It's not about emojis, though, because those did not exist in 1998, to the best of my knowledge.
They did not, even on AIM, which I would think now would have been the perfect place for emojis.
Oh, definitely. That would have really highlighted your like brand new lyric away messages.
I had a brand new lyric screen name.
Ooh.
Sucker for acoustic, but the four was the number four, and the I in acoustic was a one.
Oh man, now I'm now trying to think of like Syracuse pun brand new song titles, which I might just shout out in the middle of this podcast.
That's fine. what else would people expect at this point?
It is almost June, so we're in the straight doldrums, and you might just get like random discussions about, you know, Syracuse player names stuck into emo type song titles. It's just, you know, it happens.
This is actually pretty much in our wheelhouse.
Oh, very much so.
Anyway, for those who weren't on the site today or didn't get to see the Twitter fervor of me poking the Vols bear numerous times, Tennessee's been using an orange emoji to express things on Twitter for a long time. Or at least the last couple of years. The official account uses it, students use it, most of the commits use it. The problem is, that's our thing. You know, I think every school kind of has their emoji that they utilize. You know, LSU has a tiger, Alabama usually uses an elephant. There are plenty of other ones. We have an orange because, obviously, we are the orange. Our mascot is an orange. It would make perfect sense that we would have an orange as our emoji that we would utilize on you know, social media. So I kind of just finally had it with Tennessee and decided, you know, let's just poke the bear a little bit and tell them, you know, give it back. And here are some alternatives for you guys. So negative at the beginning, but constructive towards the end. I was actually being helpful, to be honest, as a not rival fan, but an opposing fan nonetheless. Ends up that our friends at SB Nation College Football retweeted it. A lot of Tennessee fans came out of the woodwork to tell me that I was very wrong and then used incorrect information to prove as much.
Yeah, if you didn't know, Syracuse football has only had a program since like 1987.
Yeah, that's when there were five programs in 1987, we went undefeated, and that's the only reason we went undefeated is because we played Rutgers, Princeton, Temple, Harvard and Dartmouth twice apiece, and then we tied Auburn, who was the only other program, and that's how we went 11-0-1.
My favorite moment of this Twitter, and I wasn't following it too closely, I was working and whatnot, but someone tweeted at Kevin from the site and was basically like, after a lot of like soul searching, he's like, you know what, I will admit, and this, well, these aren't his exact words, but they're like in the ballpark, he's like, I will admit that Syracuse basketball is probably better than Tennessee basketball. And I just looked at that. I was like, this is amazing. I love these people.
Probably.
It might be better. Tennessee basketball, which has achieved all of, like, nothing ever.
they were locked in a battle with Boston College and numerous other programs for the least amount of accomplishments with the most amount of potential opportunities in terms of, you know, power conferences and all that. And let's not even get into the fact that the SEC has been infinitely more winnable than any conference Syracuse has ever been affiliated with.
I think the most famous moment of Tennessee basketball history might be Bruce Pearl's barbecue.
I think the most famous Tennessee moment of Tennessee basketball,
aside from like women's basketball, right, which obviously
that's
they're
what I was
awesome.
About to say the most famous part of Tennessee men's basketball is Tennessee women's basketball.
Right, like, and that's not an act of Tennessee women's basketball, which is fantastic.
Just pointing out just how much more important Tennessee women's basketball is than Tennessee men's basketball.
RIP Pat Summitt. Tennessee men's basketball just couldn't be more irrelevant. So, and Syracuse football right now not that relevant historically. Like, behind Tennessee football, but not, like, that much. not in terms of comparative to the two basketball programs. So, if we're going to do that, like, that just was kind of silly. But I did appreciate that one guy mustering the emotional strength and maturity, honestly, to admit that Syracuse basketball has maybe been a slightly better program over the years in Tennessee. Good times.
Yeah, way to go, guy. I don't want anyone, especially if non-Syracuse fans are listening, this isn't some sort of, you know, overly defensive reaction on our part. This isn't, we're very much, spend 5 minutes on the site or on the Twitter feed or listening to any amount of discourse Dan and I put out there over the years, and you'll find that we're not a group that is unaware of, you know, our station in the world. That said, there's definitely something off about creating this kind of fictional gulf between, like, you know, Tennessee and Syracuse football historically. Recently, sure, it's there, but all time, I wouldn't say as much. Syracuse, the 18th winningest program of all time. Unfortunately, Clemson is probably going to surpass us this year, which adds extra ire to the situation. I haven't looked at the numbers most recently enough to look. I really hope that the opportunity for them to pass us doesn't come when we play each other. Because I'm sure that'll be the first time the Clemson fans decide to use a calculator all year. And we'll make sure that fact is tweeted from every rooftop in my general direction, because while Clemson fans, another Orange fan base that tries to irk me from time to time. While Clemson fans are no longer tweeting me every week with missives and a lot of anger, they have no problem tweeting at me when Clemson loses to Syracuse. I mean, Clemson beats Syracuse, excuse me. That hasn't happened in football yet, and when it does, I will throw a parade on Marshall Street myself.
Oh, man, the site will be just the day that happens, and that could be in 2023. Like, will be so good. It will be just such quality content. No one will know how to deal with it.
I write a story every hour.
Hey guys, it's like Wednesday afternoon at like 4. Like, guys, you remember what happened on Saturday?
I would honestly, I'd write the same story and then just like change like one detail. And then just file it over and over again.
Oh, God. There's no amount of griefing that'll be inappropriate for whenever that happens.
So I guess talking about emojis, because obviously Syracuse is the orange, and we're gonna keep that. Of the available options, Dan, what would you recommend for Tennessee? Does a dog work? Does the checkered flag and maybe an orange diamond work? Does just the orange diamond work? I feel like they have all. I mean, there was the mountain landscape too for Rocky Top. I feel like they have all these options available to them, but for some reason, just blatantly refusing them for a shade of orange that they don't even wear.
And a fruit, like, there's nothing to do with them.
Yeah, you guys aren't fruit. You guys don't even, do they even grow fruit in Tennessee? I feel like there's very little in terms of fruit products there.
No, that's the other thing, like, that irks me. Like, Tennessee does have, like, a fair amount of history, and it also has a lot of, like, random symbols and stuff. So you would think that they would have more available to them to pick from. Like, you have the mountain. Yeah, we have, like, one thing. we could do like a snow the snowflake, but like
that's a terrible pitch to kids from Miami.
Right. Yeah. Right. Hey. Yeah. Let's remind everyone of this. No, oranges is perfect for that. It's like, yeah, we have oranges here too in Shine under very specific conditions. No, like they have, like you said, the mountain. You could do like some kind of smoky thing. You have a dog. I mean, you have an awesome, very good dog mascot. You have the Sun Sphere, which is a weird landmark that is the most, apparently was constructed in 1982, and that is perfect, because nothing has ever looked more 1982 than the Sun Sphere.
Yeah.
You could do something with that. Like, there's just so much stuff, and they chose an orange. The orange diamond, like, we understand that that is also your color, but, like, there are more orange options presented to you in the grand scape of emoji that are out there right now and ever expanding. So hopefully they like, that's the thing. Like even the multiple tiger programs like use different tigers.
Right.
But Tennessee just locked in on the orange. And I just like, I get like go big orange, one of their things, but like, come on, just let us have this one thing. It's annoying. And it's annoying for me because I have to like follow recruiting nationally and whatnot. So every time I see these oranges popping up, like there's a good 75% chance that it's Tennessee and not Syracuse, but I get excited every time.
Yeah, it's it definitely causes confusion. I do feel like everybody else manages to, you know, just make it work with, like you said, there's differences for all the Tiger programs. There's plenty of other differences around. Obviously, Duke is the Blue Devils. I think Northwestern has some sort of Wildcat-related thing. I don't even know what theirs is, to be honest. But yeah,
they do some purple stuff, like purple diamonds, I think.
Purple's fine. You can do that. I think Rutgers has, like, a sword or some shit, or a shield. Everybody has a thing, and, like, everybody's fine with just staying in their lane. I think, you know, Purdue uses the train, which is fun. And that's the thing, like, as much as the emoji thing seems stupid, and that's why I posted about it, because it's sort of right in our wheelhouse, at the same time, like, it is a side conversation of one of the most fun parts of college football, and that's, like, all the stupid traditions and all, like, the goofy, like, there's the outward brand, and then there's, like, the other, like, parts of the brand. Like when you see, like, Purdue, like, the train thing is, like, an extra part of it. Like, Purdue Pete's, like, the horrifying, like, outward personification of Purdue. like there's all these elements, and like, you know, the emoji battle has kind of just become like another way to do that. So yeah, it is confusing why Tennessee wouldn't want to stake out claim to something that's a little bit more obvious for them. I mean, I would say that it's likely the majority of recruits tweeting oranges of late are probably more Tennessee focused, but that's also a directive from the school. If the school decided to stake out their own area of the internet somewhere else, I'm sure that the recruits and I'm sure that students would all fall in line pretty quickly.
Yeah. Also, I'd just like to add in that one of my favorite games is playing on Twitter now is this a person being recruited by TCU or is this a horrible racist?
Ooh. That is... Yeah. There's also plenty of issues with, because you can't do a regular frog.
It's too bad, because the frog emoji is great, and there's only one frog program. So, like, TCU just had that riff from them real hard, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's not great. It's highly unfortunate. TCU, you know what? Maybe you should adopt Kermit. So do the frog sipping tea as your thing.
Like, whenever they get those kids at, like, Texas offers after they've already committed to TCU.
I feel like I want to have, like, I want to write an entire, like, how-to book about, like, how to make social media and college football fun, but also, like, troll the shit out of your enemies at the same time.
hey, that'd be so much fun.
Like, I'd love to see what A&M would do. A&M would probably get the would probably have to write the first few chapters of that.
The fact that A&M hasn't pulled some strings to get a horns down emoji yet is unfortunate.
Oh, it's gonna happen. I'm sure that,
like, find a way to get the like rock horns like upside down, and then you're perfect.
I'm sure that that is coming, Dan. What else happened recently? I feel like some stuff did. Let me pull up the site. I don't have it up right now. I'm sure we had things occur. Kickoff times were released for several games this year already.
No nooners yet. I mean, there will be, but not yet.
There will be, although at the same time, I feel like the two of these games were kind of our best chances for them.
Yeah, I mean, these could have easily been, I mean, there are obviously two Friday games stuck in, so those wouldn't be at noon, but the two Saturday games would have easily, like, those are easy nooners. So 3:30 starts, I think, I don't know about you, for me personally, on the East Coast, I think 3:30 is the optimal start time, and also it seems to be the one we get the least. So,
especially for an in-person kick. I think, like, if you're going to be at the game, 3:30 is really ideal.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know if I'll be making any of these. I might try to make Central, just I'm not sure when else I can get up there. I would have gone up for Clemson on Friday night, but I have tickets to go see Modest Mouse that night, so best laid plans. I'm fine with the Friday game, and it's Clemson. You know, we've had some weird Friday night stuff happen at the Dome, and weird against Clemson would benefit us, I think. Friday night opener is not ideal. We actually talked the other day about with that Liberty schedule, which have we discussed Liberty yet?
We did not, because that was Friday.
Right, I wasn't sure if that happened before the last podcast.
We'll get to that now.
Yeah, well, we can transition in. I actually kind of like, I hope that we actually start on the road more often. I don't remember doing it that often. I think my freshman year we played at Northwestern week one. But Syracuse has this weird issue with home openers because it always runs up against the fair, and that's a big deal. And we always end up getting stuck with these awful Friday night games that are not on television, and they're against awful opponents. And I just think overall, like, we're a program that could definitely benefit from playing on the road to start. I know it's not like ideal for other reasons, but I'm actually kind of a fan of it for that reason. So I don't know. I'm not surprised that Central's on a Friday, but it's Central Connecticut. So at that point, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get 30,000 people in the Dome, maybe. You're going to hopefully get an easy win. There's not going to be that much hype for it. So it is what it is. It being Friday or Saturday or whatever doesn't really make a huge difference, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point with Friday has always been to try to catch everybody before they leave town. I get the purpose of that, I suppose. But at the same time, I feel like if you're leaving town on Saturday, you're probably pretty anxious to leave on Friday, or you're anxious to put everything together to leave on Friday, because if you go to the game at the Dome at 7 p.m., you're not leaving
till 11.
Right, you're not leaving till 11. It becomes, so it's basically just as bad as having the game on Saturday. I do agree with your plan. I think that, you know, while I wouldn't normally endorse going down to a program like Liberty, at the same time, like, it's probably not the worst thing. I think in the future, you know, the mandatory P5 game could be an option, especially if we start scheduling more toward, like, even with our competition. So, like, a game against Maryland, you know, week one at Maryland wouldn't necessarily be that weird. It would actually be able to be on television somewhere, versus these games, which end up being throwaways. The Liberty game will probably be an ACC network extra kickoff in a few years when that happens. Again, versus like a game against Maryland, which two Power 5 schools, neither of which are amazing, but they are evenly matched and therefore could create some interesting television on a Friday or a Saturday. I do think that we might be seeing either we're seeing the beginning of the end of those FCS openers for Syracuse. Doesn't mean they won't play an FCS team. They'll do that later in September, or we're seeing the ground set for the Carrier Dome renovation.
Yeah, I actually think an interesting option would be to try to burrow our way in. And, you know, I think with Wildhack there are probably more options in terms of getting creative with ESPN. I don't know why we wouldn't try to burrow our way into those Thursday night games when we are hosting at the Dome for week one. Because at least then, like, people might be taking off Friday anyway if they're trying to get out of town early for Labor Day. I honestly don't think the attendance would be that much different, yeah. And you have less competition. Like, you're running up against South Carolina most years, but they're not even playing on it this year. There's usually, like, one, like, Colorado State or some, like, weird game out west. But at least you're like one of like the five games, and real college football heads are watching like all of those. Like I watched that like awful, I think a couple years ago, the first game of the season was a Wednesday, and it was like Georgia's State in their first game at FBS.
Oh yeah, playing. I watched the hell out of that.
Yeah, I watched the entire game. Who did they play? They played still an FCS program. No, it was like maybe Valdosta or something. It was a really bad game. I'm gonna look it up while we're talking. But like that's not a bad idea either. Because then you still have people in town. I don't think the state fair has big stuff going on Thursday night. If you put it at 8 o'clock, like people can get there after work. And you know, worst case, I don't think the attendance would really be that much different. Best case, you know, you get a little more TV attention. If it's a beatable opponent and you're playing Dino Babers ball, you're probably going to put up like 50 points. Like, I think that's a better option than Friday or Saturday, honestly.
Yeah, no, I totally buy that. I think that the getting in on that Thursday action would be of interest to us. I think, you know, people do watch it. I mean, it's Georgia State again, but I think Georgia State faced Charlotte last year?
They played Abilene Christian. It was their first... the year was 2014. They played Abilene Christian at the Georgia Dome. There was like 3,000 people there. They won 38-37, and it was their only win of the year. Yeah. And then the year after, they bounced back and made a bowl out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere, yeah. I think it was either that year or last year that they faced Charlotte. It might have been 2 years ago, and it was, like, Charlotte's first game as an FBS team.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And, like, both teams look putrid, but, yeah, I still watched the hell out of that game, and I'm sure a lot of other people did, too, because, you know, you're so far removed from the last time you were watching live college football. Obviously, there's, like, the Week Zero games now, so we get a couple of those this year. San Jose State is utilizing that with USF this year. Stanford and Rice are doing that.
That weird early week one, but like it's not even week one, it's like week zero.
Yeah, although Stanford and Rice are like playing at Australia, which, whatever.
At 12.
But at least like, I mean, I understand that, but like at least Cal and Hawaii made sense.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why Rice football is going out to Australia, but more power to them.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be like five people from Rice there. Like, at best, because it's a Houston private school.
Maybe Rice just really needed a punter for a couple years, and they're like, we figured it out. We got it.
Recruiting trip. It's perfect.
It's a recruiting trip. We're going to go get six punters.
You know what, though? Like, I'm very much looking forward to probably, like, 3 years from now when, like, USC and Washington and, like, kicks off, like, the Tokyo Dome.
Oh, that's something like that stunning. The Pac-12 is way out there on some weird games, and people don't really notice as it's the Pac-12. But, like, the Pac-12 is already doing stuff that if the SEC did, like, SEC fans would be so mad.
And lose their goddamn minds.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, and rightfully so, I guess, in a lot of cases, the SEC. Like, you can't... There's no point in removing those games from the on-campus atmospheres, which have created... You know, the mythos, real and imagined, of SEC football. While Pac-12, yeah, there are traditions, but, like, you're not really missing out on much not having a game at the Coliseum or not having a game, you know, up at UW. Like, Utah's a gorgeous stadium, but, like, if you moved a Utah-Colorado game to Texas or you moved it to Hawaii or Australia, like, nobody would necessarily shed a tear about that other than the season ticket holders who probably didn't get into Justin Rate for the one game that they didn't get. But yeah, for the SEC, you lose an entire part of the character of those games. And I think that's why you see a lot more kind of hand-wringing about those games getting moved to neutral sites from SEC country than you do elsewhere, just because of the hit that the entire product takes on that front versus a lot of the other leagues. It's just not as extreme of a game day difference, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I buy that, and I get why the Pac-12 is more lenient to do it versus like you said, there's just not, it's not the same atmosphere at most schools. Obviously, there are some schools that have built good things, but even so, like, their fans are just not going to be as gung-ho about certain stuff. I mean, there are, like, when Arkansas plays their yearly game at Little Rock, people get a little upset. So, like, Arkansas is not going to play in Beijing. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Although, could you imagine Arkansas fans in Beijing?
Oh, now I really want it to happen.
Big Bert and Little China?
Just Bielema talking about, just making weird sexual references about the opportunity to spread the Arkansas brand to the East.
Oh, God. Before we get to halftime, I just did want to talk a little bit about Liberty. This actually is a good segue for the second half of the podcast, where we'll be talking a little bit about independence. Liberty will be transitioning to the FBS and will be an independent, at least in the short term. They do not have a conference invite, and unfortunately for them, I don't think they're getting one anytime soon, barring realignment Armageddon. For those who don't know, and we won't get into the politics of it, but we will get into the legal ramifications here. Liberty has a lot of strong ties with Baylor. They hired...
Some would argue too strong.
Yeah, some would argue too strong. Ian McCaw, who's directly involved in the Baylor sexual assault and cover-up issues and domestic violence issues, is the AD there. He's hired several former Baylor staffers who were still embroiled in the NCAA investigation and issues, and who knows when that's ever going to end. Liberty has its own issues with Jerry Falwell, who founded the university as the president. I'm not going to get into, again, not getting into the politics of it, just getting into the morally problematic parts of those two gentlemen and the school that they stand for. As Dan and I talked about on Twitter, and other people talked about on Twitter last Friday when the game was in, when the games were announced between Syracuse and Liberty, I wanted Syracuse to schedule someone they could beat. They did that, so beggars can't be choosers. However, this is not necessarily what I had in mind. I think Dan and I might have joked on the podcast like a month ago that Syracuse was going to schedule a bunch of Liberty games, and they went ahead and did that. I don't want to get myself into any hot water here, but just want to say I wish we could have scheduled someone else, but if we're going to schedule them, let's beat them by 100.
Yeah, I think that's what most people took. Like, we've had such issues with scheduling. I think when this actually broke, I saw before you, and I messaged you on Slack, and I said, what if I told you that Syracuse has signed a three-game series with a team that it should absolutely be in a good recruiting area for the one road game, and also you're still going to hate it? And to your credit, you didn't... I think we both, like, took it, you know... Syracuse did a very pragmatic thing. It was not perfect. I would rather not be playing Liberty, but, like you said... Syracuse should win these games by a total of, like, 140 points. The one game, the road game we have to play is the 2019 opener, I think, yeah. In Virginia, which is a place we recruit, which we talk about. If you're going to have to play crappy teams on the road, don't play them in, you know, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, somewhere where we recruit regularly. It's just, you know, it sets us up with three games that we didn't have before. Like, we're actually starting to build these schedules down the road. Our 2019 schedule now is pretty manageable. We have two non-conference road games, but again, one's at Liberty, the other one's at Maryland. And then who else do we have that year?
Holy Cross.
Holy Cross and...
we still need one.
Is that a Notre Dame year, or is it we're still waiting on one?
We're still waiting on one there. 2018 is Wagner at home, Notre Dame on the road, and who else? There's another 20. Oh, UConn at home.
Yeah, so like 2019 at Maryland, obviously usually wouldn't be at Liberty, but it just fell that way, and that's fine. We should still win that game. They're not going to be any good unless something disastrous happens or they decide to go, like, take all of Baylor's good players. And then you have, I forget, first Holy Cross. So basically have, like, functionally two FCS games where you're getting the full credit for the Liberty game.
Right.
I'm assuming they're going to add another Mac-ish opponent and not like Alabama. That's like a model schedule for the rebuilding Syracuse. Like, that's pretty good. You'd rather have three home games on conference, but you can work with it. And then you get Liberty twice at the Dome in the following years. Like, I'm encouraged by the thought process. Liberty has its own baggage, but Syracuse is behind the eight ball enough where I'm totally fine with the whole beggars can't be choosers thing. I don't think it's fair to say by playing Liberty, you're endorsing everything Liberty stands for, or what Ian Shaw has done, or what Ken Starr has done, or anything else. That's a little bit of a stretch. I'm annoyed because I already know it's going to come up, especially because we happen to have a head coach that was connected to Art Briles before this. But it is what it is. Like, hopefully people aren't too crazy about that. And also, it's Syracuse at Liberty in the first week of 2019. I think there will probably be other games that people are discussing that week.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also, again, without getting into the politics of it, I'm glad that we avoided the 2018 announcement that Donald Trump dropped at the Liberty.
Oh, thanks. Thank God.
And, oh, we're not even the only Power 5 program to... because, to be honest, I'm pretty sure we're getting money for this game.
Oh, probably. They're paying, aren't they? Like, they're playing, like, a bunch of other schools in 2018 and beyond, the ones that Trump announced.
OU is getting 1.3 to host them.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what we're going to get because we're hosting two games, but I bet we're getting at least something.
Yeah, I bet we're getting at least something, or worst case, it's a break-even, and in that case, like, well done, John Wildhack, and whoever else is handling scheduling on this.
A break-even when usually that's a body bag game where you're paying them to come twice.
Right.
Like, Liberty is in a weird situation because a lot of schools are just not going to want to play them, so Syracuse is actually in an advantageous position in terms of scheduling. It took advantage of it to its credit, so I think the positives do outweigh the negatives. The negatives are annoying. They're not deal breakers, and I think it will get a lot more attention in the Syracuse community than it will nationally. And I think those of us in the Syracuse community can like figure out, like understand more why we did this versus like, you know, if people are really going to rake Wildhack and Babers and whoever else over the coals for this. Like, I think it's a little bit of looking for an issue that, while like I get the optics aren't great, I don't think it's actually something that's there. I don't think we like actively sought out Liberty. I think it just, as for what Liberty is, I think we just found a school that it lines up with what we need, and we took it.
Right. No, completely. That's a good place to head to halftime, and then we can resume the discussion of current and future independent schools. So, Dan, what have you been drinking?
I've had a few new things of the last couple weeks. Let me go back a little bit. Last week, I got to hit up Innerborough Spirits and Ales in Brooklyn for the second time. They re-released their Stay Gold IPA, which is delicious. Picked up a four-pack of that and had one of those there. Four-pack is waiting for me, although I should get on that soon, since it's a fairly fresh IPA. Also had their Mad Fat Fluid, which is delicious as well. Better than I remember the first time I had it, and that's one of their signatures. I had... over the weekend, had some Sculpin, had some other normal stuff. I'm currently drinking another Innerborough, the other one I picked up. Their collaboration with Industrial Arts, which I've talked about before, is a upstate brewery that made some really, really good hoppy beers. Mm. This is called the In Crowd. It's billed as a double session, a session double IPA, in that it is a double. Has a pretty strong hop profile, but it's only 6%, which is a little stronger than a normal session, but I guess with a double IPA, that's about what you're going to get. I don't know that I would actually session this beer, but it's pretty good. I also had yesterday, from Industrial Arts itself, State of the Art 115, which was really good, and then probably the best beer I've had in a while, Hill Farmstead Society in Solitude number 8, which was a double IPA. I think it was at like 9%-ish. Just really, really good. Super complex hop profiles, but very drinkable. Like, super, super drinkable for how hoppy it was. Really liked that. Definitely one of the best things I've had in a long time, which isn't too surprising because Hill Farmstead does really good work.
Fair enough. As always, jealous of the Hill Farmstead access. I know
I like force myself to get it. Anytime I see anything Hill Farmstead that I haven't had before, which is often because, like, if you see Hill Farmstead, like, odds are they've made something new. I always just make myself get it, even if there's some other stuff that's good too.
Yeah, that's fair. I know definitely a problem I had when I was in New York in March twice. I definitely pursued everything they had to offer. A couple things that I was drinking in the last week had from Real Ale down in Texas. I had their Benedictum Mysterium Verum. It's a sour brown ale. It was really, really good. I had Smog City's Pinkies Out Anniversary Beer, their Saison. I also had from Smog City their 630 to Yakima. It was their pale ale. It was super good. I got a growler of that. Headed over to Hermosa Beach. Went to Abigail, had a Consummation IPA and a Das IPA, which is a West Coast IPA that they use German hops for. So created an interesting profile. Nothing crazy, but just a good IPA to sip on. Also stopped at the German sausage place near the beach. Got a Warsteiner, German Pilsner. It was delicious. I'm glad I had that to wash down some dinner. Stopped at this one spot that I hadn't been to, kind of a little bit further north, up in L.A. proper. Barbers at the Brewery. So the brewery is this kind of art collective area up in L.A., and this beer bar, Barbara's, is over there, and it's pretty well renowned. Hadn't been up just because it's not really an easy place to get to from here, but tried out State Brewing's Project Vanilla, as well as the Double Dry Hop Thrill Seeker from Beechwood. So had Thrill Seeker before, I've mentioned it on the show a few times, but the Double Dry Hop version was very, very good. Also had from also from Real Ales down in Texas, a buddy of mine sent Sisyphus, their barley wine. Had Alpine Windows Up IPA, drank some house beer from local house brewing. Had a Pliny the Elder because seemed like the best thing that was on draft at a bar I was at. And then had a mic check. It's a Czech Pilsner from Boomtown Brewery, which is a not like super new, but I think it's like the last 6 to 9 months they opened in downtown L.A. So yeah, thought it was an uneventful weekend, but nope, ends up a drink quite a bit.
As you'd imagine for Memorial Day.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes. All right, so talking a little bit about independents here. For this coming season, there are 4 independents. Some school in South Bend, UMass, BYU, and Army. And Dan, what do you think about the current state of independents, you know, in college football? Obviously, Syracuse was a longtime independent. There's always talk about, you know, some of the bigger schools that could potentially be independents. You know, Oklahoma, Texas, Alabama could all survive, USC as well. But what do you think about the current state of independent programs? Do you think this is something that we're going to see more of? It seems like the pool is going to be growing in the next few years. But is that just a temporary swell before it shrinks back down again?
Yeah, I could see it like expanding like 6 or 7, depending on, you know, teams that are joining FBS for the first time. But I think for most programs, like especially newcomers to the FBS, like you want to get in a conference just because scheduling is such a problem. And for Notre Dame, like they're a big name, they can get people on the schedule. They have all their rivalries and they have the ACC agreement. But like even them, like the ACC agreement helps them out now because they were having some issues before that in terms of like, you know, either overloading their schedule or trying to deal with like playing teams they don't want to play. Like they played Miami, Ohio the other year. I don't think they'd want to do that most years.
Or like San Jose State or all these other teams that ends up on their schedule.
Right. Like they still have to add some schools that are like, it's great for those schools and like it's a win for Notre Dame. But I think in an ideal world for them, they'd rather, you know, be playing like the types of schedules they used to. But then those schedules are sometimes now too difficult for what Notre Dame puts out there every year. So I think the ACC actually works out for them in terms of the 5-game agreement. Obviously, there's debate whether or not they should join the full league. I think we feel one way, obviously. But even like among Notre Dame ranks, I think they're probably pretty pleased with where they are, which is why they re-upped it to 2037, I think, is how much farther we have with that deal now. I don't know. I think that'll probably be... I'm further under the impression that Notre Dame's going to just keep riding that until either NBC decides it doesn't want to pay that much money for one school anymore, which is a possibility considering what rights deals are starting to look like.
Well,
or,
and with the fans, I mean, at some point, the people who religiously tune into NBC for Notre Dame football every Saturday, you know, are going to die.
Yeah. that's a legitimate thing. Like, younger Notre Dame fans, I don't think care nearly as much about their independence as older ones. Or if the ACC network or any other network that would, you know, for a conference that would look to add Notre Dame, which I think is probably all of them, starts making so much more money than Notre Dame makes by itself, then I think you can see a move. But for now, I think they're fairly happy because the money's about even for most, even with the ACC projections, and they still get to do most of their rivalries, and their other sports are in a good place. So I don't think a Notre Dame move is impending by any means.
No, I would have to agree there. I think the team to watch with regard to independence is more BYU than anybody else. We talked about it here before. Other places have talked about it too. BYU is kind of landlocked here. If the Big 12 is not going to expand, Big 12 seems like they're willing to make compromises around the around some of BYU's views socially. The religious component of BYU is a non-starter for the Pac-12, so that cuts them off there. So for BYU, it's really just it's Big 12 or bust. I don't think that any of the other leagues would really be interested there. The Mountain West isn't what it used to be, but I still think that, you know, that there's not enough hurt feelings over there that they wouldn't welcome back BYU with open arms. I mean, you think about how many of the schools in the Mountain West are now, like, you know, WAC converts, and like recent WAC converts, not like the old school WAC. I don't even know if they'd have the votes to keep them out. And when you consider how many of those schools in the Mountain West, I mean, BYU probably schedules what, at least three or four of them every year. You know, how many of them play BYU regularly? I don't think anyone would bat an eye at bringing BYU back into the fold. But the question there is then, can BYU equal the payouts that it's been getting from ESPN? And right now, yes, but maybe 5 years from now, no. And then also, like, what type of value is BYU to the Mountain West? Obviously, BYU is a valuable property. Where it falls on that total line, I'm not sure. But then also, yeah, like, how much... I mean, this is what the Big 12 had an issue with of, you know, which schools really add to the per-school payouts. If you're the Mountain West, you are firmly... seventh overall out of the 10 conferences. So does BYU get you closer to parity with the American Athletic, or are you still, no matter what you do, even if you add a BYU, going to be pretty far behind?
Yeah, I think BYU is in an interesting place because I think their aspirations are probably up there with staying independent unless they can get Power 5. But realistically, I don't know that it's going to work out. Obviously, the Pac-12, you outline the issues there. The Big 12 just doesn't seem to know what it wants to do with expansion. And the other leagues just don't make any sense for them. So I kind of get why BYU is where they are. Scheduling-wise, like you said, they end up playing a lot of those Mountain West schools anyway. I don't think their schedules would change all that radically. You just play like less of the random like schools that are farther out east in like the back end of their schedules where they're playing more of their less sexy games. I think they'll see out
one.
Right. So you'd swap those out for the San Jose's and the Wyoming's and whatnot, which is not a huge difference. So I just think that they've already been there, and they know what the Mountain West has to offer. I think the Mountain West would take them back in a second. I don't know why they wouldn't. When you're one of those leagues, I don't think you can really get too worked up over who's coming on and like hurt feelings. I just don't think it works out for those leagues, which have to be pretty forward-thinking and pragmatic about things. But I think BYU would probably feel like it's taking a step back, or at least like resigning its fate to mid-major status, where they obviously have some loftier goals. So just staying independent might like be the best option for them in terms of, you know, not succumbing to like, oh, hey, we're just one of the best of these other schools that never really have a chance to play for anything. That being said, I don't really know that how the schedules work out now that BYU is in a position to compete for a national title, just because their schedules are not quite good enough. They're not deep enough. Like they have some really good top end games. Obviously, they played the two game series with Texas a few years back when Texas was on the outs with Mack Brown, and they beat the hell out of them twice. And like that still looks good, even if Texas wasn't that good. But like, there just aren't that many. They're not Notre Dame where they can just command like eight really marquee opponents every year. They can get like three, and that's just not quite good enough to get them in the playoff discussion, even if they go undefeated, I don't think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that right now they're looking at like three or four, maybe five. You know, Boise State usually ends up on that schedule, and Boise's happy to schedule them. There's no bad blood there because they shared a conference for a year, maybe. I don't even know if they did. Actually, no, I don't think they did. That was BYU's last year in the Mountain West was Boise State's first year. Well, was right before Boise State's first year in the Mountain West. But yeah, I don't The problem is now for them is that because they're not in a group of five league, they don't actually qualify for the Access Bowl bid. But then that just gets into, you know, what are BYU's goals? And BYU's goals, first and foremost, and this is where they differ from Notre Dame, is that BYU's goals, first and foremost, are, you know, the Mormon mission, the Church of Latter-day Saints. Like, that to them is more, is football is a way to get their message out there. While, like, Notre Dame, their goal is to be an amazing football program that competes for championships. And if people happen to like Catholicism along the way, great. BYU, on the other hand, is a little more church-forward. Obviously, they want to win, they want to compete, but they're fine being in this 8-4, 9-3 wheelhouse that they've kind of settled into.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the Access Bowl thing. That is interesting. It's just a matter of, like, I don't know that joining up in the Mountain West that's still not, like, it's not like they're signing up to win to the Orange Bowl every year. Like, that's a tough spot to get in. It's very competitive. There's always, you know, you have the risk of, like, a Western Michigan this year. The MAC seems to put out, like, a really, really good team every 3 or 4 years. You have the AAC champion, which should always be, like, a top 20 team. You have Boise State sitting there in the Mountain West. I think that's a nice thing. I just don't know how realistic it is for BYU to even, like, win that or get there often enough to make that worth the jump. Now, you know, maybe after 10 years, BYU gets tired of the effort put into, like, having to schedule out an independent schedule, which is a real bore, and I'm actually kind of surprised that, like, UMass has stayed afloat as long as it has, having to do that as a much less attractive program and one that's in the Northeast and whatnot. But, for now, I think they're probably okay treading water and hoping, like, the Big 12 gets, like, frisky again at some point, which is bound to happen. I'm sure conference expansion is not done forever in terms of the Big 12.
No, definitely not. And I think, yeah, like, BYU's in a better situation probably than Army, if only because they might command a little bit more national dollars and eyeballs. Obviously, a lot of people do watch Army, though. Army is just at a different place competitively. You've seen what they've done lately, where they've really tried to schedule the dregs of FBS and a couple, like, bigger games, but not really huge games. And their new kind of path is being competitive and competing for a bowl bid, and that seems to be working out for them. And I think that it's resulted in them getting better players. Last year is what they went 7-5, 7-6. I think that's kind of around a ceiling for an Army team, but I think BYU has better upside than that even. What I would be curious to see in 10 years is, you know, if the Big 12 doesn't exist anymore, like, that's where I see a return to the Mountain West, is if BYU goes to the Mountain West with, like, say, Kansas State and Iowa State. Or maybe even Baylor, if Baylor gets murdered by sanctions and can't really get out from under the boulder.
In that dream scenario for Oklahoma to the SEC or Oklahoma and Texas to the Pac-12 or whatever. Like, I love that we've had, like, all of these reports. Like, this year, this offseason's actually been, like, less crazy with it, but, like, the one this year is, like, Oklahoma is clearly hot and bothered and annoyed by all the Texas stuff and they want out. And, like, it makes sense. Like, the theories hold, like, make sense logically, but, like, who knows how much that actually is happening behind closed doors. Obviously, Dave Boren tends to talk more than most college presidents, but I don't think the things he said publicly quite line up with, like, Oklahoma's, you know, one foot out the door, and all it takes is, like, one annoyed booster to run into Paul Feinbaum on the street, and you get, you know, a fun rumor. So, I don't know how close we are to that stuff either, but I'm all for if expansion wants to keep on pumping, like, it's I'm all for it. I enjoy speculating wildly.
Yeah, I mean, as long as I think the ACC is on solid enough ground where we don't have to worry about ourselves. But yeah, as long as the Big Ten's not poaching teams and all that, I think people are looking more realistically now. And I think the Big Ten, I think 5 years ago the Big Ten would have tried to grab Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia Tech, schools like that. I don't necessarily think they can do that anymore. Because it's not about expanding the TV footprint and all that. I think that if they were to expand pipe dream would be Missouri, but Missouri's not leaving the SEC and the money there. So Oklahoma and Texas become kind of the obvious targets for the Big Ten in terms of improving and bolstering its football product. And I think that's really going to be, if there is a larger realignment shift coming, that's probably where we head. That's probably where we head next is an addition of actual football programs and things that make sense in that regard. But again, I'm no expert, but I know you, me, and a lot of other people kind of came into this industry writing about this stuff. So while it's been a few years since we've been, you know, drowned by it each and every day, I think that we're still pretty well versed in the rules of realignment and the shifting factors there. Another shifting factor, just for, you know, whether it's Notre Dame or I think less Notre Dame, but whether it's BYU or Army or UMass, upcoming Liberty, New Mexico State's going to go the independent route. Like, the availability of games, like, as when you have three of the five power conferences with, you know, nine game schedules in conference, that leaves only three games to play with out of conference. All the G5 leagues are going to stay at eight because they need those, you know, expensive payouts from the power conferences and those beatings that they take for the most part. But, like, you look at Liberty's schedule, even for, I think it's 2019, they're playing home and home with New Mexico State, like, in season. I think that spells really bad things for Liberty long term if they're not going to get an invite, and they might not. New Mexico State, who I think is screwed unless, you know, somebody at the Mountain West decides to throw them a lifeline, and I don't really know why you would, to be honest. And then why am I blanking on the other one? Oh, and then UMass, who's perpetually screwed at this point, unless there is realignment elsewhere.
Yeah, I almost feel like those schools kind of need to just start, like, why don't they schedule each other to, like, just long contracts? Like, what's the downside?
Well, potentially, like, payout, I guess, if you have to break the deal.
Yeah, I guess, but, like, and I know UMass probably doesn't want to be flying to Las Cruces every year, but... that's where.
But they're flying to Hawaii Mexico every year already.
Yeah, so, like, I feel like just getting the games on the books is more valuable than, like, if you're UMass, are you really putting together this awesome 12-game schedule, like, every single year? Like, obviously not, so I don't know why you wouldn't just book up and say, hey, we have our other independent buddies who are in this other bad situation. Let's just, you know, do even payouts and have a standing date where we're like, we'll play Liberty until X, we'll play New Mexico State, we'll play whomever else needs a team, just because, like, that just takes care of, what, a quarter of the schedule about, or a third of the schedule, or not a third, like a 20-25% of the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, for them, it makes perfect sense. I think, you know, UMass was at least smart in the fact that they've been able to get on the radar for Hawaii, and they've been able to get on the radar for, I mean, I don't know why Hawaii would play them, but whatever. They've been able to get on the radar for some SEC schools. They've been able to, you know, get that kind of running series. I don't know how long it goes, but that series with BC and UConn and those three schools facing one another, which makes perfect sense. That there's a funny commentary in there about the state of UConn and BC football, but whatever. I think the reason that Syracuse, as much as I hate them not getting out ahead of these things, the reason Syracuse hasn't scheduled a team like UMass is because... I think they don't want to get left, you know, holding the bag if UMass gets invited to the American Athletic Conference or gets reinvited to the MAC or randomly ends up in Conference USA for some idiotic reason. Like, I think Syracuse is, as much as I hate to admit it, they're being really smart here to not schedule UMass because they don't want to get embroiled in that. I think with regard to Liberty, I think the thinking might be a little bit different, if only because it there's more upside to the decision when it comes to recruiting, when it comes to our fan base and where they are in Virginia and Maryland, the D.C. area. For us, another trip, a potential trip to Massachusetts, and you know, when we already go there every other year, doesn't really do us any favors.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that UConn and BC even... Like, if I'm one of those schools, and I know that they're a good deal better than UMass, and they're not, like, I don't know that UMass even a huge threat to, like, UConn football, but why wouldn't you just say no? Why wouldn't you just not schedule them and see what happens? Like, they might, if those two schools, who obviously don't work together or anything, but, like, if there was a group of schools in the Northeast that just said, we don't want to play UMass just because, like, UMass would probably have to just drop their division.
Yeah.
But, you don't have to be all that openly contemptuous for any reason, but the second that UConn feels any threat from UMass, like taking recruits or anything, I don't know what the recruiting relationship is between them. I don't know how close UMass gets to competing with them.
Probably not all that close. Based on the rankings I've seen.
Yeah. Does UMass ever break like 110? No. I don't think they do. But if they did, like, say UMass is like flirting with like the 90s or 80s or wherever UConn is, like, if I'm UConn, I'm just saying no. Just no, we're never playing you.
Well, if UConn loses to UMass once, that program's cratered. And like I don't think they get that. I mean, it's not like UMass is swimming in resources, but UConn definitely has more of those still. But I would kind of bet that there's a lot more people around, you know, UMass Amherst that might be willing to spend on football. Not being like, you know, amazing, but spend on football being passable than maybe UConn has with their boosters spending on basketball already.
Yeah, and even like those are the two those are probably the two premier big public schools in the Northeast. They're probably drawing. I mean, obviously, like UConn's gonna be more Connecticut kids, and UMass will be more Massachusetts. But like, I know UConn draws from out of state a fair amount for what it is. Like, I feel like if I'm UConn, like I want to stay the only big public New England school with prominent-ish FBS football. And, like,
but I guess UMass, you also want to win.
You also want to win, but, like, there's a universe where UMass could infringe on their stuff. Now, I think they would have to enter a conference that's, like, similar to the AAC and, like, compete around the same level that UConn has in terms of, like, making bowls somewhat often and building some kind of identity, which I don't know that they have. But if UMass did, like, if UMass built an identity and had like a stadium on campus, which I think was in the plans. I don't know if those plans have gone anywhere because UMass has been kind of in limbo.
It's back, but I don't know if they're playing every game there yet.
Oh, is the stadium like open?
Stadium's open. I know, but I mean, my sister never went to a game the entire time she was there, but the stadium is open.
I get that you like being able to say you play at Foxborough is cool. I think the idea of it is so much cooler than driving, what is it, like an hour and 45 minutes to get there? Like
an hour and 45 each way, and then for students,
it's, and then no one's
up,
there.
Yeah, it's getting up super early. There's no one there. It's waiting in line for a bus. I mean, I've not apples to apples comparison, but like the parking for the Rose Bowl is largely in downtown Pasadena, and then it's like a mile and a half from downtown Pasadena to the Rose Bowl. So there are shuttle buses and mostly just school buses for the local schools. They're utilized on weekends for those. That's a very short ride, but almost every single UCLA game I've ever been to, I've walked back from the Rose Bowl to downtown Pasadena because the idea of waiting for a bus, I mean, anyone who's gone to a Syracuse game even knows waiting for a bus to get to South Campus is infuriating and an impossible dream.
I was going to say, Syracuse fans don't wait an hour. I mean, Syracuse students don't wait an hour or don't take a bus a mile up to main campus. Like, I don't know, like, how many UMass fans, and I'm sure there are some diehards and more power to them, how many UMass fans are waking up every Saturday for noon games to go schlep over to Foxborough to watch a bad football team lose to some SEC program they signed a 3-for-1 with, because I'm pretty sure they played half the SEC East last year. Like, literally, I think they played half the SEC East last year.
They got Mississippi State this year.
Yeah, they played Florida, South Carolina. I know they played Vandy recently. I feel like they played Kentucky recently, or they're going to. I don't know. Their schedule's so weird. I just don't get, like, stick it on campus. That's a party school. Like, you have a shot of, like, some kids wandering drunkenly into the stadium having a good time. For Foxborough, you just don't, like, there's no chance. No one's going to that. It's so far. Like, we make fun of UConn and Rensselaer. Like,
this is so much worse.
Rensselaer is so much closer than Foxborough is. Like, Rensselaer is like, you can get there in 25 minutes if you hustle. This is so far. This is across the state.
It's not great.
This would be like Syracuse playing, like, we've talked about, like, when the Dome gets renovated. It'd be like playing in Buffalo. And at least that's, like, we've talked about that. That's, yeah, there's people there. Foxborough is not a city. There's a Dick's Sporting Goods and, like, some, like, hunting shops and, like, all the stuff that's built around there for when the Patriots play. But it's not like, you know, UMass ain't the Patriots.
Yep. All right. I think that was, I think that's a pretty good summation of what's going on with Independence, right? There's no 4-8 teams that we left out that are probably important that we might want to discuss. I don't think so.
How important could they be? They went 4-8.
Using the same logic people use about Syracuse, if you went 4-8 last year, you probably ain't that important.
We actually talked about them way more than I thought we would.
Yeah.
So, sorry about that, everyone. I know we made promises to our listeners. I don't know that we kept them, and I only hope to do better next time.
I'm sure we will. I think we have either the Sun Belt or Conference USA next week.
You know what? Notre Dame is definitely not in the Fun Belt, and never will be.
They're definitely in CUSA West. Way to go, Notre Dame. Guys, you made it.
Notre Dame, UTEP.
Oh, boy. Anyway, Dan, thank you as always for joining. Much appreciated.
Yes. Enjoy your everyone's freedom from college sports for a couple months until we drag you back in late August.
Indeed, indeed. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Troy and Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and theoretically, go Orange.
Go Orange, not Tennessee.